Mitch had used. So we now have Mitch's DNA. So I'm sitting, just waiting for this to come back, and then we can go and effect an arrest on the East Area Rapist. Then I get an email from Paige. Mitch has been eliminated. Once again, that feeling of, how could it not be him? And I started thinking about the surreptitious collection and hitting the lead agent up going, there was two other men sitting at that table. Are you sure you got DNA from the right person? But I was assured, no, we got the right DNA. And I had to just accept that Mitch was not the guy I was looking for. This put me in a tailspin. Though I felt my investigative strategy was solid, the smaller haystack approach was a good one to take, but nothing looked promising to me. And I thought, I might be at the end now.
Paul puts the Golden State Killer case to the side for a moment, and it's during this time, while thinking about another case, that a new idea hits him.
In February of 2017, I was called over to the sheriff's office to participate in a conference call with San Bernardino. This conference call dealt with a homicide of an Asian female, Eunsoon Jun, whose live-in boyfriend, Larry Vanner, had bludgeoned to death and then put her in a shallow grave underneath her own house. We always referred to this case as the kitty litter case because he had dumped a ton of kitty litter over the body to prevent the smell from getting out. He was shortly arrested after that homicide and ultimately pled guilty to it, so he was in custody. Larry Vanner wasn't his real name, and we knew that because he had used at least 20 different names over the course of his life, had 10 different social security numbers and dates of births. He obviously is hiding his identity. We didn't know who he was, but we did see that he had an arrest back in 1986 down in the Santa Cruz area for child abandonment. And he had abandoned a six-year-old little girl named Lisa Jensen. Well, we proved that Lisa was not biologically related to him. He was not her father. And we were convinced that she was a missing girl from somewhere across the nation. So for almost 15 years, we had tried to identify who Lisa really was. So this conference call that I was invited to, Detective Peter Headley from San Bernardino, starts detailing that he had worked with a genealogist and they had identified Lisa as a missing girl out of New Hampshire. Her name was Dawn Bodin. And I was asking him, how did you do that? And he indicated, well, we had done this autosomal DNA testing. And he was saying they'll send to Morgan this and SNP testing that, but he wasn't real sure exactly about the technology, but said this Barbara Ray Venter was the one that had taken this type of DNA and used it in order to identify Lisa as Dawn Bodin. I walked out of that meeting going, I need to figure out exactly how that's done, and I need to call this Barbara Ray Venter ASAP.
I'm Barbara Raventer. So there's genealogy itself, which is basically, that's family history research. Then there's genetic genealogy, which is how I would normally describe myself, which is basically applying genetics to genealogy or family history research. And then there's what you're calling investigative genealogy or forensic genealogy, where you're then taking basically the genetic genealogy and applying that to solving a crime.
I was like, huh, why hasn't anyone done this before to try and solve homicides?
Chapter 10, Profile of a Killer. We're now entering the last and most incredible phase of Paul Hull's investigation into the Golden State Killer. When Paul's suspect Mitch was eliminated, Paul was ready to throw in the towel and quit the case entirely. He began investigating this case 24/7, 365 back in 2011. Now it's 2017. There isn't enough maker's mark in the world to drown out Paul's frustration. But he's not quitting. He's obsessed. Which is why he develops a revolutionary idea. The use of genealogy to fish for the Golden State Killer's name. But before Paul calls genealogist Barbara Rae Venter and heads down this exciting path, let's take a moment to look at who the Golden State Killer really is. What do we know about him at this point in the investigation? The answer is a lot. Paul, it's great to see you.
It's good to see you, Jim.
The Golden State Killer started his first crime spree in 1974, breaking into houses in Visalia, California, when no one was home. Visalia was a small, isolated town of 30,000 people in the heart of California's agricultural San Joaquin Valley. Windows could be found open during hot summer days. Doors were left unlocked. It was the perfect playground for a burglar.
1974 in Visalia, California, a series of burglaries were starting to be committed by an offender that became known as the Visalia Ransacker. This was an individual that was going into houses, typically with nobody inside the house. He wanted to go into the women's undergarments, and he often would take these women's undergarments and lay them out on the bed or just throw them around the house. He'd go through looking for jewelry items, but often would just take silly things such as piggy banks, blue chip stamps, and single earrings as souvenirs. His MO was to break into these houses when nobody was home. During the course of this series, he was highly prolific. He committed over 100 known burglaries in a matter of about a year and a half. But around a little more than two-thirds the way through this series, he escalated. 16-year-old Beth Snelling is asleep in her bed, and she wakes up, and the Visalia Ransacker is laying on top of her, and he's got his hand over her mouth. He proceeds to pull her out of her bed, and she's struggling with him. He pulls her out of her house, but her father, Claude Snelling, hears this commotion and runs to his daughter's rescue. The Visalia Ransacker heard Claude coming towards him. He lets go of Beth Snelling, pulls a gun out, and shoots Snelling. Claude Snelling is killed. At this point, Visalia Ransacker kicks Beth three times in the head and runs off.
Unlike his later murders when he's premeditating his attacks, he's reacting here. But his murder of Claude Snelling shows he will kill if he has to. His attempt to pull Beth out of the house suggests he's on a path to becoming the East Area Rapist. It makes me wonder whether he committed other sexual assaults during this time period that we just don't know about.
Yeah, well, that sounds like an unplanned event. He didn't think this out in advance, and perhaps he was surprised to find someone in there and just reacted impulsively at the time.
That's right. Visalia PD is actively investigating this Ransacker series, as you would expect, especially now since it appears that this guy is willing to kill. Officer Roger McGowan, who is the primary investigator for Visalia PD, at one point accurately predicts where the Ransacker is likely to hit next. So Officer McGowan stages himself in a garage at a house, and at a certain point at nighttime, he sees the Ransacker across the street, up on the side of a house, go in front of the house, and then start to go into the backyard through the fence gate. Officer McGowan goes and confronts the Ransacker at that gate. He's got his flashlight out, shining it on the Ransacker, whose back is to him. The Ransacker turns around, ends up pulling out a gun and shooting Officer McGowan. Fortunately for McGowan, the bullet strikes his flashlight and McGowan is saved, yet the Ransacker is able to escape. This is in the end of December of 1975. At this point, no other burglaries or other cases are attributed to the Visalia Ransacker.
Police officers can get overwhelmed with tips, and sometimes they have to rely on their gut to choose which leads to follow first. Sounds like Officer McGowan had pretty good gut instincts. Murder and attempted murder of a police officer are obviously two of the most serious crimes a person can commit. But most of the crimes that the Visalia Ransacker committed were petty break-ins. Did this juvenile behavior continue when the Ransacker became the East Area Rapist?
when you start talking about juvenilistic behavior. Now you get further into the East Area Rapist series. Attack number 30 on the official list. Again, two teenage girls that he goes into the house when their parents are gone. And during that attack, at a certain point, he stomps out of the room and he's saying, "I want to stop. She's making me do this. Mommy, mommy, mommy."
Really?
And you go, now is he just pretending to make these types of statements? Or is that really what he's experiencing, what he's feeling?
Well, one of the things we know about serial offenders and most offenders is that they play these offenses out in advance in their mind. They fantasize about it. They build up to actually doing the offenses. Many times they'll stalk their victims, they'll stake out the place, they'll know exactly what they want to do, and then they'll go back and enjoy fantasizing about it. And that fantasy is always perfect. Right. There are no flaws in the fantasy. But when it comes to the real world, when they're actually acting on those fantasies, when they're actually trying to fit this current victim into that fantasy, typically things go wrong, and that can get them very frustrated. So that might be what happened in that case, because he set up this fantasy and he wanted it to be this way, and it wasn't that way.
Yeah, and that makes sense. He's fantasizing about the perfect scenario when things don't go right. That's when they have some issues. Mm-hmm. In one attack, after he pulled this 15-year-old girl out of her house down a canal, and he gets to a point where he's cut off her jeans, and he's thinking possibly that she was an American River College student, and when it's turning out, no, she's a high school student, and there's a possibility he confused her for a neighbor, he ends up pushing away from her and makes a statement, "This isn't going right." He never sexually assaults her. He ends up just leaving.
Paul, I have here the original FBI profile done in 1977 of the East Area Rapist. The original FBI profilers, whom are my close friends, colleagues, and mentors, began interviewing incarcerated serial killers to gain a better understanding of their thinking. Their hope was to use that information to catch active serial killers.
So reading this profile, it starts out, the first one is white male. A lot of people say, well, you always say white male. Well, that's absolutely not true, actually, because there certainly have been serial killers and serial rapists of all races, of
right.
all ethnicities. And so we look at the victimology to reflect back and determine what race the offender is. And for particular types of crimes, offenders don't necessarily cross racial lines, but other crimes they do. And you just have to know the nuances that tell you the difference. They say the subject is either unemployed or employed in a job requiring minimum contact with the public, unskilled or semi-skilled labor, basically. So why do you think the profile determined that he would be sort of underemployed, that it would be sort of low skill jobs and occupations?
When you read the case file, he's making statements when he's entering the house, "I'm here for your food and money. I need food and money," as if he doesn't have a job, as if he's unemployed, and he's moving around the countryside and is having to attack just to survive. Part of this is his MO, because he's trying to put the victims at ease as, "I'm just right. trying to, you know, I'm not here to hurt you. I just need your food and money, and I'll leave you alone." But he would also do behaviors like sit there and shake as if he were undergoing withdrawals from
really?
Drugs. So he's doing this verbal staging, and I know when I initially read these case files, I kind of bought into that those staged statements, and I'm going, I'm looking at a guy who's younger, who is sort of this, what I call the troll under the bridge type of offender.
Right, but once you figure out that that's staging, it raises the level of his forensic sophistication and his criminal sophistication. The fact that he's not driving up to the residences of the victims that he's picking, but actually, whatever vehicle he's using, he's parking it a distance away, and he's approaching on foot, quietly. The fact that they wake up and he's already standing there over them with a mask over his face, with a knife in his hand, exposed, half naked, those are all things that are definitely part of his fantasy. And the people that plan and execute fantasies like this, very sophisticated fantasies, are usually of higher intelligence. So, Paul, I have here the updated profile done by the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit in 2013. And in contrast to the three pages from 1977, This is 29 pages of comprehensive analysis. There's a lot more nuance to it. That's because the original team, Douglas, Ressler, Hazelwood, they interviewed about 35 offenders. By the time I went through the unit, that number was over 1,500.
Wow.
So in 2013, who knows how many they've interviewed by now.
It's a lot more data that they're working
with. Oh, absolutely. One of the first things they talk about is victimology and the choice of victim. So we know that offenders pick victims based on availability, vulnerability, and desirability. And if someone is available and vulnerable, and they can't find the desirable victim, they'll pick whoever they can. And sometimes offenders will just randomly pick victims. Somebody like Israel Keyes did that. He sort of set a trap, and whoever fell into that trap would be his next victim. But others are very focused on a particular victim at a particular place in a particular time for a particular purpose. And so I believe this killer, the Golden State Killer, actually was the latter. I think he actually picked his victims. He chose them carefully, and then he built a fantasy around them, and then he tried to act out that fantasy.
Right. One notable case, the very first case where there's a man present, he's having the woman put on high heel shoes and get on top of him and straddle him on the sofa. And he's manipulating her like he's been fantasizing about what he's wanted to do for her for a while. Versus in some of the cases, he's very derogatory to the female victim. He's kicking them in the sides. He's not doing all this other type of manipulation. It is straight missionary style sex where he never lets his body down onto the victim. And I've kind of dug into that thinking he may have some of these women where he's seen from afar and he's been fantasizing about, but then other cases where there's that anger, that power and control that he wants to exhibit, and that is the primary motivation in those.
So when we look at the East Area Rapist and look at the type of offender he is, we know that we break down rape typologies into four major categories. You have power reassurance rapists, you have power assertive rapists, you have anger retaliatory rapists, and you have anger excitation rapists. Power reassurance rapists, basically, they typically treat the crimes they commit, the rapes they commit, as dates.
Yeah.
And they will actually, in their minds, set up a situation where they are actually just dating this woman. And they typically will use weapons only to control and not to actually hurt the victims. Of course, there's outliers, and sometimes when they're cornered, they will lash out. But in general, they will do things like say, "Can I see you again? Did you enjoy yourself? You should lock your windows at night," and things like that. Get a dog, not a cat.
And that's crazy. In fact, we just had a case solved that I had worked over my career of a power reassurance rapist. The NorCal rapist is a prime example of what you were just describing.
And then the power assertive. These are people that, as you described, take out their anger that exists outside this incident on the individual. And typically that's, "I am powerful and I'm going to prove it to you. And I'm going to prove it to you, I'm going to beat it into you." They're usually more violent, they're more aggressive, and they're domineering. Then we move up to the anger retaliatory. And these are people who are not just trying to control the person, but literally hurt that person. They're carrying around a very severe anger and rage. And then the ultimate category is anger excitation. And this is typically a sadistic type of offender who actually gets off sexually on causing and witnessing the suffering of his victims. Sometimes, so much so that they will forego what we call traditional sexual activity, and they will become sexually aroused and even sexually satisfied by causing and witnessing the pain of others. What typology do you feel the East Area Rapist falls into?
He most certainly was inflicting psychological stress on these victims. He was all about inflicting fear. He's coming in and he's hissing at them through clenched teeth. "I've got a gun. If you don't do what I say, I'll blow your brains all over the wall." Anytime they talked, it was, "Shut up. I'm dominating you," right? But he would do things like move silently around the house, and the victims think he's gone. And in one instance, the mother, laying next to her 7-year-old daughter in bed, thinks he's gone and starts talking to the daughter, and the daughter says, "Shh, Mommy, and he's standing right there and pushes down on the bed to let her know, I'm right here, scaring her. I'm seeing an offender that is retaliating against these victims for something that is making him angry in his normal life. Mm. And the victims are a proxy for whatever is making him angry. I do think that earlier in the series, he's more of this power assertive. He wants to express power and control. He's dominating them. He's playing psychological games with them. So I see this spectrum where it does appear that he toggles a little bit between power assertive and anger retaliatory, but I gravitated towards classifying him more in that anger retaliatory category.
Paul, let's discuss MO. It's very clear that the East Area Rapist changes MO significantly over time.
Well, at the very beginning of the series, in June of 1976, East Area Rapist goes into a house. You've got a young woman asleep in her bed, and she wakes up, and she sees him standing in the doorway. And he's standing there. He's got a T-shirt on. He's got a mask on. He's got a knife in one hand. He's erect. She's nude from the waist down.
Yeah.
He jumps on the bed, puts the knife to her temple, and says, I want to fuck you.
Mm.
Over the course of the next 15 attacks, you see him experimenting. In the very next case, after that first case, he's attacking two teenage girls.
What is his goal in taking two victims? Is it proving to himself that he can overpower two people at the same time? Does that help him feel more powerful?
I think it does, but it also was telling me, well, this guy's done more cases than we know about. And that's one of the factors where I've used over time thinking, he's older than what most people think. This is not a teenage boy.
Mm.
He's done more cases, and now he has the confidence to take on two girls at the same time.
What about the plates? He would pile plates on the back. He would have the husband lay on the ground, pile plates on his back, and tell him, if you move, if I hear these plates, I'm going to kill your wife.
Yep. Or I'll kill everything in this house if there's children in the house.
And in the end, did he ever kill those men?
Down in Southern California, he did kill the men. Now, in those instances, we don't have any evidence that he had put plates on their back. He went into those bedrooms knowing he was going to kill those men. So it appears he's changing his MO once he escalates up to homicide. In the earlier cases, he's using those plates as an alarm system.
Mm-hmm.
Most certainly, that is physically torturous for these men who have their hands bound behind their back, their ankles bound, and now they have plates on their back and they can't move at all.
They know their wife is being raped. And they know they have to be perfectly still. No matter how much they want to fight and try to get free so that they can save their wife, they can't do it. And how demeaning.
Paul, as we sit here today, what's your biggest unanswered question about the Golden State Killer?
I have to know, what was motivating him internally? What was he feeling that drove him to go out and do these fetish burgs in Visalia, ultimately become the East Area Rapist and attack these women? And then why was he doing some of the almost ritualistic things with the women in terms of how he's binding them up? Because he always did that consistently. And he had a signature sexual component to his attack. Where did he get that from? Is that coming from something in his background? Did he experience something like that? Or was this something that he read about and fantasized about, like in those true detective magazines?
Mm. Yeah, you know what I'd like to ask him?
What's that?
Why'd you stop?
Yeah.
Why did you do it for so many years? Why did you rape so many women and kill so many people? And then all of a sudden, just stop.
Yes. You see some of these other serial killers who were prolific, such as Green River Killer.
Mm.
And then they did stop. Why? And then you hear about Gary Ridgway, and when he was asked that question by, I believe it was Mary Ellen O'Toole from the FBI, and he looked at her and he said, oh, I got married. His life changed.
Chapter 11, A Revolutionary Idea. When Paul learns that genealogy can be used to identify the name of an unknown person using just their DNA, he gets an idea. Paul has more evidence about the Golden State Killer than he knows what to do with. But it's not telling him what he ultimately wants to know. He spent his career looking for a name.
So I get back to my office. I reach out to Barbara.
Barbara is genealogist Barbara Ray Venter.
She's succeeded with this approach before, but she's never used the technique in a criminal investigation. Actually, no one has.
He then contacted me and asked me if I would help him with one of his cases. He did not say which case it was. He just asked if I would be willing to work on a case to identify a perpetrator. I Googled his name to see what cases he was working on, and I came up with a couple of different cases which looked like they were pretty high profile. One of those was Galton State. Well, I had actually never heard of it before, and so that was then when I started researching the Galton State killer, and I could see why he was very anxious to solve this case. I mean, I was truly horrified seeing the extent of the crimes that this man had committed.
Up to this point, Barbara Rae Venter has used genealogy to help connect people, usually children who don't know who their real parents are. Now, Paul's asking her to help him find the name of a serial killer.
She graciously responds, asks what I have.
Because I'm a civilian, obviously I'm not part of law enforcement, so I was actually given a very limited amount of information. With all of my cases, the very first thing that I do is I try to put together a little profile of who it is I'm going to be looking for. So in this case, Paul sent me part of a report they had which gave the ethnic background, which, as I recall, had some Southern European and the rest, I think, Western European. And so that was all I actually had from Paul. Unfortunately, about a week after I had told him that I would help him, I was diagnosed with some medical stuff. So I was actually out of action for a while.
Then I didn't hear from her. I thought, here's another genealogist that does not want to help out law enforcement. So I'm going to be left to my own devices to figure out how this investigative genealogy actually works.
Barbara Rae Venter didn't set out to become an expert in building family trees. But over time, she inadvertently built the perfect resume to become the world's first genealogist to help bring about an arrest in a serial killer case. Barbara Rae studied biochemistry, earned a PhD, in fact. She added Venter to her name because she was once married to Craig Venter, the man who helped map the human genome. She also earned a law degree and specialized as a patent attorney for biotechnology inventions. In 2006, a family tragedy led her to genealogy.
Back in 2006, my parents were in a car accident in Kerikeri, which is in the North Island of New Zealand. And my mother was killed in the accident, and my father was in the hospital for several months. I was actually staying in their home, and my father had asked me to take care of paying bills and so on. So I found my grandmother's birth certificate in his desk. And I had always thought that all of my relatives were off the boat from Scotland. And so that then led me on to a quest to find out exactly what the family history was. And it turned out it was quite complicated. My grandmother's paternal relatives were all part of the Scottish clearances. They went first to Adelaide in South Australia. Unfortunately, there was a typhoid epidemic, plus the gold rush was starting, and there were pours and boos and all kinds of things that these staunch Presbyterians were very unhappy about. So they wrote to the governor of New Zealand and asked for land in New Zealand, where they set up a Gaelic-speaking community. There was a little memorial house in Waipu, so I went in there, and I was lucky enough that the genealogist was in there. My grandmother's maiden name was MacLeod, and she was also a MacLeod. She actually remembered my great-grandfather, so she told me all kinds of stories about him. So it was sort of an interesting start to my dip into genealogy. I have a DNA junkie. I turned to using DNA to try and connect some of the dots because the paper trail just is not there. So I started with testing my brothers and my son. Then I just started testing everybody. So I've got a very large number of people in my family who have tested, and I myself have tested at probably just about every testing company. Being a sleuth is in my DNA. My grandfather's, one of his brothers, was a detective inspector with the London Metropolitan Police. He would have been actually, I believe, with the London Metropolitan Police at the time of Jack the Ripper.
In March of 2017, about a month later, we had a working group meeting on the East Area Rapist, and that was held up in Sacramento. I had found a very weak, from a genealogy standpoint, match It was only across 12 markers, which is trivial to the genealogists. But the East Area Rapist had a very rare marker type that this match in the database also shared.
The California DNA database Paul used contains DNA from various sources, including felons who spent time in the California prison system. Paul found a weak DNA match across just a handful of markers. The chance is low that this person will turn out to be the Golden State Killer, but it's the closest anyone has gotten to finding someone who shares any DNA at all with the killer.
And this person was up in Oregon. So I briefed the working group on this technology and told them that I had communicated with this Barbara Ray Venter about this other technique, but she hadn't responded back. After that meeting, the FBI called me up and said, Paul, that match that you found to the guy in Oregon, that seems to be the most exciting lead that we have. We need to pursue that. And I said, oh, thank you. You know, I thought I was going to be left to myself in terms of trying to track that down. And now I've got the FBI willing to help me. I said, well, I want to come along. You know, it's my lead, and I want to be there to help with that process.
Paul and two investigators from Orange County travel to Oregon to get a DNA sample from a man in a convalescent home. The man signs a form allowing them to take and test a sample of his DNA. Then the team flies back to California to do the test.
It showed that he was not closely related to the East Area Rapist. And at this point, basically, the attorney that was helping the FBI said, nope, we're not going to provide any additional resources. This is when my partner in the final year of my involvement in the case stepped forward. Division Counsel Steve Kramer out of FBI LA, he called me up and said, I'm hearing what you're saying about the DNA. I believe that the DNA is going to be the direction we need to go in this case. I want to help you. How can I help you with this? And so I proceeded to tell him, I've got this autosomal DNA that I'm trying to figure out. I need to ultimately get this special type of profile called a SNP profile generated from the East Area Rapist cases in order to be able to do this technique. Kramer immediately understood that this was the way to go, and he said, whatever you need, we will provide it out of the FBI Orange County office. So now I've got the feds backing me up as I'm proceeding to go down with this new DNA technology.
Paul and Steve Kramer hatch a plan. Their best chance to find ancestors of the Golden State Killer is with an autosomal DNA profile, which they don't have. To generate one, they need to find a well-preserved DNA sample of the Golden State Killer. He was careful not to leave behind hair or blood when he committed his crimes. So the best DNA of the Golden State Killer comes from sexual assault kits. But it's in short supply and closely guarded. Up in Northern California, the DNA is all gone. Sacramento, Stockton, Modesto, and Davis destroyed their evidence after their cases passed the statute of limitations. And Paul had already used up the DNA he'd found on the second floor property room of the sheriff's department back when he was a young criminalist. The only way forward is for Paul and Steve to get a sample from one of the original Night Stalker attacks, which turns out to be much more difficult than it sounds. Law enforcement, in the places where the Golden State Killer attacks occurred, want to guard the evidence they have in the hopes of solving the crimes themselves. So if Orange County, Santa Barbara, and Ventura even have good DNA left, they're not about to just hand it over to someone else, especially to try out a new technique that's never been used in a criminal case before. Paul and Steve will have to convince one of these agencies that investigative genealogy will finally unmask the identity of the Golden State Killer. It's a sales pitch, so they hit the road.
At this point, I go on a roadshow with these different agencies, in essence, trying to sell them on this technique. I'm trying to be a salesperson saying, give me a portion of your very valuable and limited Golden State Killer DNA so I can pursue this particular tool, the investigative genealogy. So what most people don't realize is that when an offender leaves DNA at a crime scene, it's only a certain amount of DNA that he's left behind. And each time we go in and test that DNA, we're consuming it. can think of it sort of like a pie. Each time you test that DNA, it's like taking a slice of pie away from that whole pie, leaving a little bit less. And then ultimately, if you've tested so many times, all you're left with is crumbs. And in many of these cases, that's all we had left from the Golden State Killer were crumbs of his DNA. And so I'm going to these agencies saying, give me some of those crumbs. That's a big decision for these agencies to make. Now we're driving eastbound. I know where I'm going here. It's roughly about 35 minutes without traffic, but today there's always traffic that we're having to battle. Steve Kramer is a bulldog of a personality. He is the type of animal that will bite and not let go. It was just almost like a symbiotic relationship. I came with my skill sets, my expertise on the case, my technical knowledge on the DNA. He had his attorney expertise, and he had that bulldog personality and the federal authority that helped this thing be successful. When we were looking into the legalities of this investigative genealogy, he's reaching out not only to the technical experts back at Quantico at the FBI's laboratory, but also other legal experts within the FBI or the U.S. Attorney General's office and talking to them about this process. And they were coming back saying, absolutely, that is legal. In addition, there was conversations with Anne Marie Schubert, and nobody came back and said, nope, not legal. You know, but of course, this could be a sensitive thing. Well, we're not going to let sensitive stand in the way of trying to catch this guy. We need to figure out who the Golden State Killer is.
So as I'm on this roadshow talking to these agencies with my partner, Steve Kramer, about this investigative genealogy technique, you know, one of the questions is, well, how do we know it will work? Well, I know it works because I ended up testing my own parents' DNA. They had gotten their DNA profiles generated through Ancestry.com, and I was able to upload them into this open source database and ended up experimenting to figure out how the investigative genealogy process could work. So as I'm talking to these agencies, trying to convince them to get the DNA, I am admitting this is a brand new technique, but it is proven. It's proven to identify Jane and John Doe's. I did it with my own parents' DNA. I can see how to do it. So that was my primary pitch. Even though you're giving up some of your valuable DNA evidence on this brand new technology, I think there's a good chance we'll be successful. But it's not a silver bullet. My first stop was with the Orange County District Attorney's Office. I was trying to sell them that this is a new investigative approach that we could use in order to solve this case, but need a source of DNA. Of course, at this point, this was very early in this roadshow process, and the thought within the room was, this is really new. We need to dig into this a bit more to really understand the pros and cons of using this tool. However, I told them, hey, I'm shaking trees all over California. We don't have the time. I want to try to solve this case before I retired. My partner from the FBI, Steve Kramer, and I believed this technique would work. And so we continued the roadshow and talked with other agencies that had DNA to try to convince them, let us use your sample so we can pursue this and maybe close this case out. So our last stop in this roadshow was down at Ventura DA's office. And that's when Steve Kramer, his partner, and I went and met Steve Rhodes plus one of their laboratory personnel in order to explain this investigative genealogy tool. Ventura was very interested, and Steve Rhodes said,
heck yeah. I've always been a work outside the box kind of a guy, and I thought, yeah, I can see where this works. So I go, shoot, we don't need a warrant for this. Let's do it. And I love it when that, you know, as they say, when a plan comes together, and this one did. It was a cool move on Paul's part. It really was. And the rest is history. It's going to be a game changer.
Awesome. Finally, somebody is buying in. Ventura said, let's check our DNA sample to see if it's something that can be used to move forward and try to get that genealogy compatible profile done. So Steve Rhodes goes back to his agency. I drive back up to my agency up in Northern California. We're communicating back and forth. Their lab is starting to take a look at what evidence that they have remaining. And then Steve Rhodes calls me up and says, I think we're in luck.
In his research, he found out that the pathologist that had conducted the autopsies had made it a routine habit to collect two sexual assault kits. Usually, almost exclusively, pathologists only collect one kit, and that gets turned over to the law enforcement agency, and those swabs from those kits are what ultimately get consumed looking for DNA. Well, he found that that second kit had never left the coroner's office. It had been maintained sealed in the coroner's storage unit all these decades untouched. No DNA analyst had gone in there and started cutting those swabs up and consuming that valuable DNA evidence. So whatever DNA was present at the time of collection was still inside that sealed kit. He submitted that kit to the Ventura Crime Lab. They analyzed it, and they came back with a huge amount of our offender's DNA. This was a major, major milestone in this case. And we got a genealogy-compatible profile in January of 2018.
The Golden State Killer's DNA profile includes all the DNA in his 23 numbered chromosomes. It's now common knowledge that every person is born with a different combination of DNA, meaning the Golden State Killer's DNA is unique to him. That's because each of your first 22 chromosomes contains hundreds or thousands of genes. Billions of combinations are possible. The 23rd chromosome determines gender. Paul's Golden State Killer DNA profile is more or less the same kind of profile that gets generated by the thousands every day by commercial companies. You send in your saliva, and for a nominal fee, they'll send you back your DNA profile and some information about what it means. But these companies have privacy policies that'll prevent Paul from uploading the Golden State Killer's DNA. He needs a way around that. He's got the sample, he's ready to go. Now he needs someone to tell him what to do next.
The genealogist Barbara Rae Ventner, who I'd reached out to in March of 2017, she had stopped communicating with me. I had assumed that she didn't want to help out.
I contacted him again and I asked if he still needed help with his case.
And I was like, yes. What happened? And she explained that she had run into a health situation and had been unable to do any type of work during that time frame. She never had any reservations about helping us. So Barbara now started communicating with myself and Steve Kramer and getting us set up on how we can do this investigative genealogy. Once we got that profile in January of 2018, I ended up uploading that profile into this open source public genealogy database called GEDmatch. GEDmatch is a website that had been set up to allow people who had been tested in a variety of different genealogy systems to take their DNA profile from, let's say, Ancestry.com or 23andMe or FamilyTree DNA, take those and upload them into GEDmatch so they could search each other as opposed to only being limited to within Ancestry's database or 23andMe's database.
GEDmatch, or GEDmatch, is a public genealogy website with no limitations on who can use it, and it's growing.
At the time, I think it was probably around, maybe 900,000, maybe coming up on 1 million people that are in that database. It's an extremely powerful tool.
Because this GEDmatch was open source and public, I didn't have to go through any of the legal loopholes to access it. I just needed to upload my offender's DNA profile, and then that database would produce a result of the people that shared the most DNA with my offender. I uploaded the Golden State Killer's DNA profile using an undercover account.
We don't know who the guy is. That's why we're doing this. Where do they want us to put serial killer? We created a phony profile. That's all we had. So yeah, we gave him a name and uploaded the file and looked for matches. It typically takes 2-3 days before the matching is complete.
When Paul uploads the Golden State Killer's DNA into GEDmatch, he's pretty much pulling the handle of a slot machine, hoping to get a good match. The jackpot would be a match to a close relative of the Golden State Killer, a child, sibling, or parent.
but the odds against that are astronomical. Paul and the team are hoping to get as close as a second cousin. So Paul submits the Golden State Killer's DNA to GEDmatch, crosses his fingers, and waits. A person's genetic relationship to someone else is measured in centimorgans. The more centimorgans you share with someone, the closer you're related. A few days later, Paul gets his list of matches, a series of names along with the number of centimorgans each person shares with the Golden State Killer.
And so a second cousin match would be about 240 centimorgans. If you have a parent-child match, it's 3,500 centimorgans. Anywhere in between the 240 and 3,500 would have been really nice. We had 40.
Paul and the team did not get the matches they were hoping for.
It was well. So it's a long way out. What it immediately told us is probably there were recent immigrants in the family, so you weren't hooking into, you know, long-term colonial-era type folks who've been around for forever and lots of family members who've done DNA testing. We were going to be building a lot of trees. Just meant that we were going to have to work a little harder to figure out who he was.
Of course, when you load something up into this type of system, you're hoping the closest match possible. You want that brother or sister to pop up, or a first cousin. Unfortunately, that's not what we got. We got, at best, third cousins. I remember getting that search result.
We were extremely disappointed when we saw what kind of matches we had.
With these poor matches, the genealogy process becomes much more complicated and time-consuming. A team needs to be assembled to help, so Paul and Steve Kramer invite three more people into their inner circle. Steve includes his FBI intelligence analyst, Melissa Parisote, and Paul includes two people from the Sacramento County DA's office.
So there were five of them plus me.
And I took this search result. I remember emailing it to Monica, who's this brilliant analyst up there at SAC DA's office. And without providing any type of any structure or direction, I just told her, go. Thinking this is just a matter of taking the top hits and starting to build out family trees, and eventually we will land on who the stereo rapist was.
I'm Kirk Campbell with the Sacramento County DA's office. I'm a lieutenant in the homicide and gangs unit.
And my name is Monica Sykowski. I'm an investigative assistant at the DA's office in Sacramento.
So my name is Anne Marie Schubert, and I am the district attorney of Sacramento County.
Kirk and Monica, they're just brainiac types. Kirk is our lieutenant over homicide. Monica, I've worked with for years on DNA projects. She's super smart. And so Paul came up, presented it to me and Kirk and Monica was, you know what? We need to do whatever we have, what tools we can utilize to come to some solution. And that's when, you know, as I call it, you know, the little core team justice group kind of started working together, which include them and Steve Kramer and the FBI and Paul. I've had cases here where someone, you have a whole slew of people trying to find somebody and they can't find him. And I'm like, Monica, I'll buy you Starbucks if you find this person. And within 20 minutes, she's found him.
Anne Marie was so interested in it. It was just kind of contagious. I remember reading an article several years ago about a man that was suffering from amnesia and a genetic genealogist helping him figure out his identity. And I had never heard that term before. And I remember Googling it and thinking, this is interesting. But I never really put two and two together that it could be used to solve this case until Paul came along.
And I remember walking into Monica's office one day and just say, is this really going to work? And she says, it's the best hope we have. I knew that it was our greatest shot.
I did things like looked up this utility on the GEDmatch website where you can estimate eye color. And I also ran the DNA through Prometheus, which is a website where you can get medical information. What I was mainly looking for was things like, you know, had he potentially gone bald? And in his case, he had multiple alleles that were associated with early baldness. And then the eye color from both Prometheus and from GEDmatch was blue. And so that was something I added to my profile. We had in there that he had blonde hair. And so between the ethnic background, which, you know, showed the Southern European and Western European background, I sort of had an idea of what I was looking for.
I've never really done genealogy before, so I had to put myself on a crash course in order to figure out how to do it all.
Okay, there are two kinds of DNA that are passed down virtually unchanged from one generation to the next. One is Y-DNA. A father passes the Y chromosome to his son, and he, of course, inherited that from his father. So it can go back many, many thousands of years, basically unchanged. You can do the same thing with mitochondrial DNA on the maternal side. It's a little more complicated in how it's inherited. It goes from a mother to all of her children, but only the daughters pass it on to the next generation. Completely different to that is the autosomal DNA. And autosomal DNA is chromosomes 1 through 22, which are in the nucleus of your cell. And these chromosomes, they actually go through a process what's called recombination, where basically the DNA in those chromosomes kind of mixes and matches so that you get a random mixture of the DNA that your parents had. You're getting 50% of each of your parents' DNA, but what you get and what your siblings get is going to be different. Golden State Killer, we used autosomal DNA. I happen to be very visual, so I'm one of these people that talks with my hands and like to draw pictures on whiteboards. You know, when you look at your own family members, you can see the diversity that the DNA creates just amongst, you know, siblings because of the recombination process. So if we were to color pieces on the chromosomes, if you were just to take the piece of yellow segment of chromosome, and if you were looking at your own family tree, you could trace up the tree and see where that yellow chromosome came from.
A way to think about this is if you go all the way back to the great-great-grandparent level and just assign different color Lego blocks to each great-great-grandparent. As these couples have kids, certain colors that basically commingle to become that person. And through each generation, you see a reshuffling of the colors of Legos. You have these different colored Legos all of a sudden coming together and coalescing to produce the Golden State Killer's DNA sequence. But back in time, that red Lego that ends up being part of the Golden State Killer's profile, that red Lego fragment also comes down and is inherited by other descendants that are alive or born around the same time as he. So I'm looking for this match over here that shares that red Lego. This match may be mostly yellow, green, brown Lego person. They're a completely different combination of colors than the Golden State Killer, but they have that same red Lego.
Whereas the Y DNA, you can look back thousands of years. With the autosomal DNA, because of this mixing and matching process, you can typically only go back and look at your relatives maybe 4 to 6 generations back. What you like to see when you're doing this kind of research is you'd like to see second cousin or better matches. Of course, it doesn't happen all the time. And so, you know, sometimes you end up with these very distant matches and you just have to keep building trees and hoping that you'll find the right combination.
Traditionally, you build the family tree from the bottom up. You're on the first branch, along with any siblings. Directly above you, 2 branches diverge to your mother and father. Above your mother, 2 more branches diverge, her mother and father. 1 set of your grandparents, and the same on your father's side, and so on from there. The tree grows wider and more complicated as you go back in time, and the farther back you go, the more difficult it is to identify your ancestors. They may have lived overseas, spoken another language, and unless you descend from royalty, eventually the genealogical records are incomplete.
Back in the old days, people would have to travel to public centers of records in order to get access to census records or church records or marriage licenses or birth certificates. In this day, with these websites available, they have made those records, for the most part, conveniently available. So a lot of it can just be done behind the computer. But every now and then you run into a brick wall, and we ran into that. And in fact, at certain points, in fact, Kirk Campbell had to dispatch state troopers in New York to go take a look at a headstone or to go to a county records in order to get a birth certificate. What genealogists are doing in terms of following the paper trail and running into these brick walls and having to come up with a way to break through that brick wall, that's what we do all the time. So there is a lot of overlap in terms of the mindset of doing this genealogy work versus how you investigate a case. We started building these trees, and then Barbara took a look at what we were doing. And she was like, hold on here. She said, this is all wrong. That's not how you do this. You have to find a match to your offender's DNA sample on the father's side and a match to your offender's DNA sample on the mother's side and see where you can build these trees where they intersect, where these 2 matches have common ancestors.
And then once you identify those common ancestors, then you have to identify all your descendants, all those descendants, until you get down to the current day. The DNA only provides you a starting point. 99% of this technique is all genealogy, and it's working with public records, U.S. Census, birth certificates, marriage licenses, obituaries. We rolled up our sleeves and we started building trees. And Barbara was our overseer, and she would poke into our system and take a look at where we were at and give us guidance. I was going home in the evenings building out family trees. Steve Kramer's out on the East Coast, and as he's sitting in a conference on his phone, he's trying to build these trees out. Kirk and Monica were just banging out the trees that they were assigned. This was all-consuming. It's funny, my personality is such, I was impatient, I'm trying to build these trees as fast as possible, and then Monica would look at my trees and say, Paul, I think you got it wrong over here, and then she would go in and correct it.
I had no experience at all with genealogy before starting this project, so the best way I can describe it is it's like a puzzle. One day you might not be able to figure out an answer, but you pick it up and look at it the next day, and you know, you might see something that you missed or figure out a different way to, you know, solve a dead end.
We had roughly about 25 trees that we had built back in time. We had several trees in which we had connected, but those connections turned out to be too shallow. You have to go further back in time for this technique to work. Back in the 1800s, these people had many, many kids. You would typically see 12 or 15 kids per generation. And then each of those kids could potentially have 10, 12, 15 kids. So these trees became enormous very, very quickly. You know, in terms of the 25 trees that we built, we easily surpassed multiple thousands of people that we added into these trees. Now, most of these people are long dead.
I always thought that he was long dead.
And I kind of thought the same thing, either, you know, long dead or in prison in a state that doesn't have any kind of retroactive DNA collection or living in a very, you know, kind of remote area or a foreign country, you know, those kinds of scenarios, not so much that he would be living right among us still.
It was a very consuming when I look back at that couple months. I can't remember anything going on except for this.
The most important trees, the ones where we had the matches that shared the most amount of DNA with the Golden State Killer, I had given those to Monica and Kirk.
I was pretty confident that we would be able to solve the case. I have only one case, which I'm still working on, that I have not yet solved.
At a certain point, Barbara makes a statement, hey, it looks like the guy you're looking for has a fair amount of Italian in his ancestry. And that just kind of caused me to just sit back a little bit when I first saw that. Italian. Every time we tried to build the Italian trees back in time, as soon as we got to where the family had immigrated over from Italy into the United States, we would hit a brick wall because we did not have good access to Italian records.
I don't speak Italian. The Italian records have been scanned but not digitized, so you'd have to go through them one by one. That wasn't going to happen.
But as we built the trees out, you know, we weren't seeing these, I mean, all these names were your standard European surnames until all of a sudden we see a D'Angelo pop up. And that's when Joseph D'Angelo Sr. married into the tree that we were building. Everybody that we were putting into the tree were all on the East Coast. They were in Ohio, they were in Pennsylvania, they were in New York. I was like, well, we know our guy was in California in the mid-1970s. Are we just off base here? Or are we going to be successful?
It turns out that the family tree building is working. The team is able to identify 9 suspects who share some DNA with the killer and who lived in California during the time of the attacks. So Paul starts investigating them.
We're looking for males born between 1940 and 1960 who had a connection to California in the mid-1970s. Now we're comparing them to what we knew about the Golden State Killer. We knew our offender was somewhere 5'8", 5'10", definitively 6 foot or under. What's their criminal history? What's their address history? We start the gumshoe investigation, contacting former friends, former co-workers, ex-wives. ex-girlfriends.
From this investigative work, the team is able to narrow the suspect list down to 6 people. They're all the right height and age. They have the right hair color. The team is very, very close. One of these 6 people could be the Golden State Killer.
The one thing we had not yet looked at was eye color. So the